ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's most famous cave diver, Dr. Richard Harris of Tai Cave Rescue fame, sounds the alarm about the disappearing undercurrent of groundwater beneath South Australia's limestone coast.
But now, very dramatically, it has changed. And over the last few years, there has been a horrible decline in the conditions in there. Loss of visibility, loss of aquatic plants, and loss of very important fauna.
And we hear from retirees doing the post-work years differently. They're spending their twilight years working to rebuild communities after natural disasters.
My average volunteer age at the moment is 63. That will be because I've got the most amazing 90-year-old here.
I'm Sinead Mangan and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Whadjuk Country, Perth. But first to South Australia, where a federal Senate inquiry into South Australia's rolling algal bloom crisis has started to hear from expert witnesses, tourism operators, fishers and regular beachgoers to detail the full impact of the environmental catastrophe. Speaking from the public inquiry at Seacliff outside of Adelaide, this is what South Australian Green Senator Sarah Hanson-Young had to say.
South Australia has copped the brunt of this. We've got a huge impact on our fishing and tourism industries, but it's our local communities too that are suffering. Locals down here at Seacliff have been telling me just how distressing it has been finding dead marine life day after day washing up on these beaches, not knowing exactly how clean the water is, not knowing what to do when they are confronted with these dead animals. Right where I'm standing, just 50 metres away, we have had dead dolphins washing up. We've had dead stingrays and even penguins. It has just been absolutely distressing for the local community here, and it's obviously a devastation for the environment. This still hasn't been declared by the Prime Minister a national disaster because the government says it doesn't fit the criteria. Well, we need a new set of criteria.
South Australian Senator Sarah Hanson-Young speaking from Seacliff at the public inquiry into the algal bloom crisis. Our reporter Emma Masters has been across this story. Now, Emma, before we go into the parameters of what's considered a national disaster or not, what stories have you heard today from the hearing?
Effectively, we've heard from scientists and academics today. We've heard from the South Australian government, everyone from the Premier and Cabinet to SARDI, who are the South Australian Research and Development Institute, who have been really the ones that have been doing all of the testing. They are right across kind of tracking the algal bloom and trying to understand its movement. And then this afternoon, we have heard from SA Health as well. So quite a range of different people who have been presenting today, and there is more to come this afternoon as well.
Has there been much public interest in it? Are many people turning up?
There, in terms of public interest, yeah. I mean, it's one of the most critical issues in South Australia at the moment, and there were a lot of community events that have been held in South Australia prior to this Senate inquiry. The Senate inquiry really has only started today, but in terms of kind of public interest, it's kind of at the forefront of people's minds, and particularly people living along the coast and those areas that have been affected. I mean, you heard there Sarah Hanson-Young was talking about the devastation of the marine life that has been washing up and onto the beaches, and for anyone that has walked along the beaches and come across, whether they're huge giant stingrays or little leafy sea dragons, it's quite devastating at a very sort of grassroots level for people, as well as then you also have the great impacts of the algal bloom on the fishing industry, the aquaculture industry. We've had oyster farms on the Eyre Peninsula, on the York Peninsula, that have been closed down due to the algal bloom. So There's been huge economic and social impacts from this bloom, on top of the massive environmental impact that it has caused since March.
Emma, we're coming into summer and some beachgoers are saying they're unsure whether it's safe to swim. Was that addressed today?
It was addressed in the sense that the South Australian government were asked, are there any intentions to close beaches? And the question was asked on a number of occasions. There was quite a lot of prodding in and around this. And the government was very clear to say that they are not going, they're not intending to close beaches, that they will be providing information to the public about the algal bloom and where it exists, but that it will be up to individuals to make decisions in and around whether or not they go to a beach. However, what they also did say in another part of the hearing was that they are, SA Health and SA Surf Life Saving are collaborating together to develop an app. And that app will be a way in which someone who, say, in the midst of summer might want to go down to one of our local beaches like Brighton Beach or Seacliff, where the inquiry is being held today, and there will be able to go onto this app and be able to see sort of what the status is of that beach. But at this point, the SA government were very clear to say they have no intention of closing beaches. However, you know, the thing is that there's so many questions in and around the algal bloom and how long it's going to hang around, if it is going to hang around. And we know that it is affected by the sun, and it grows by the sun. So it's in many ways a little bit of an unknown as to what the situation will be when we are in the midst of summer. And, you know, so it's kind of a bit of a watch and wait as well.
There's been a great use of technology during this algal bloom. Emma, we spoke about the, on Australia Wide, we spoke about the iNaturalist app where people were cataloguing things like you said, like the leafy sea dragon, the numbers of those that have washed up on beaches. And now you're saying they're going to use an app to track the bloom itself. Did they discuss that expectation of the algal bloom, whether it will flourish in summer conditions as things heat up or whether it will start to die off?
Yeah, that was very much a part of the conversation, and what was really what came out of the inquiry really was that the most likely scenario is one that they've described as pulsating, where effectively they believe the bloom will dissipate for a while and then it will return. So they kind of said they're looking at three potential scenarios, that the bloom's just going to completely die off, that it's going to hang around the entire time and not go away, or it's going to have this pulsating effect. And they said, looking at the data that they've gathered over, this is SARDI, this SA Research and Development Institute, they've said from the data that they've gathered since the bloom kicked off in March, that it has had this kind of pulsating effect, reacting to the weather conditions and the conditions of the water. And so they're believe that that is kind of what we're potentially looking at here in South Australia.
The algal bloom has not been declared a national disaster by the federal government yet. Obviously, Senator Hanson-Young is pushing for this to happen. Was that discussed today?
Not so far, no, but it is definitely something that Senator Hanson-Young has been calling for a number of weeks now, and it is certainly something that has been echoed from industry, the fishing industries who have been impacted, aquaculture. There has been huge community calls for the government to declare it a natural disaster. We have had the Environment Minister Watt come and visit South Australia on two occasions now. Both times he's been asked very clearly, are you going to declare it a national disaster? And as yet, the federal government has said they're not going to. And I know that is sort of something that the inquiry is looking into in terms of what needs to change in terms of legislation to enable events like an algal bloom, which is something that scientists around the world are predicting we are going to see more and more as a result of climate change. You know, is there room to change the legislation so events like this can be declared natural disasters?
Emma Masters, thanks very much for talking to Australia Wide.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Australia Wide. On ABC Radio.
South Australia's limestone coast has a reputation as being a cool, green and wet region in Australia's driest state. But below the surface, the ancient undercurrent of groundwater is slowly being eroded. The decline in groundwater is fueling conflict within a community striving to balance the demands of a productive agricultural sector with the need to protect the environment. Elsie Adamo has this report.
Fifth-generation farmer Morgan Feast runs cattle and sheep on his property at Wye in the South Australian limestone coast. Like many farmers, Morgan has been worried about a lack of rain. But when a drain fed by a karst-rising spring on his farm ran dry for the first time, he knew the problem ran far deeper than low rainfall.
In the farm's history, it's been here for 130 years, no one has ever seen it run dry. That went dry for the first time last March.
The Feasts are dryland farmers, meaning they don't use irrigation. But many other industries in the lower limestone coast do irrigate to survive, with centre pivots common throughout the region, drawing water from the vast underground system. Morgan believes an overuse of this water was to blame for the drain running dry.
As far as moving forward, I may not be able to run stock on a lot of these paddocks that are drying off.
Bowen Dick Elder, Uncle Ken, has been keeping a close eye on any changes in the health of the conservation parks. From his observations, Uncle Ken believes urgent changes are needed to protect the land.
We've already done enough damage, and the true indicator is our birds, our fish. They are our messengers. They are telling us that already this underground water is over extracted.
The Limestone Coast Landscape Board is responsible for the region's water allocation plans, determining water allowances for landowners and agricultural industries. The Lower Limestone Coast Water Allocation Plan is currently being reviewed, and Manager of Planning and Engagement with the Board, Dr. Liz Perkins, is warning the community that cuts are likely.
There are certainly areas of over-allocation, and that is something that we're looking to understand and address through the amendment process. One of the key areas of focus for this amendment process is looking at what is sustainable allocation, and that is a process that we've been trying to work through with people in the region for over 12 months now. Does that mean a cut to allocation? Absolutely, that is within scope, but we have made no decisions about that yet.
The board knows water is a contentious issue and cuts will not be welcome.
Look, I don't think the board would ever pretend that through this process everyone is going to end up happy, but we do think that there is a pathway to find a balance.
But even just the mention of cuts has distressed the industries which rely on this resource. Nathan Payne is the chief executive of the South Australian Forest Products Association. He says water allocation cuts could lead to job losses in forestry.
The impact of that language is that we're starting to see investment withdraw out of forestry, and I'm told out of other commodities as well, which is potentially impacting on jobs. What we do know is if producers like forest growers do suffer cuts, those cuts mean less jobs in a mill. That's a job that somebody in a regional town doesn't have, and you'll see a hollowing out of our regional communities.
A loss of investment will limit the number of trees, a change Nathan says could impact Australia's timber supply.
We've actually suffered a reduction of 20,000 hectares of trees have been removed as a consequence of the 2013 water allocation plan. So that's circa 16 million trees have gone from the landscape.
Most dairy farms in the limestone coast rely on centre pivots to sustain a regular supply of feed. Dairy farmer Louise Poultridge says cuts would threaten not only her farm, but the region's role as a key food bowl for Australia.
I'd like not to see any cuts to water allocations for food producers, because food production is key to our food security.
Louise is concerned too much focus is currently on the environmental impacts at the expense of farms.
I have heard that, that the environmental needs would be the number one focus, but we have to consider that we need to make sure that this region is economically sustainable as well, because a lot of people rely on this area.
The benefits of the water network are not only a draw card for agriculture, but also for tourism. The underground water, combined with the limestone coast's unique geology, has created world-famous flooded sinkholes and underwater cave systems. This is where Dr. Richard Harris, famous for his crucial role in the 2018 Tam Luang cave rescue, first learned to dive.
The water clarity is so extraordinary. You know, I've been lucky enough to dive in tropical oceans all around the world. And yet when you first put your head underwater in a place like Kilsby Sinkhole or Piccaninny Ponds, the clarity of the water is actually like being in air.
Access to Piccaninny Pond's water activities was closed in recent years due to water quality concerns.
As an observer who visits the area frequently for several decades, is that you can see a pattern of change. But now, very dramatically, it has changed. And over the last few years, there has been a horrible decline in the conditions in there. Loss of visibility, loss of aquatic plants, and loss of very important fauna.
Cave diver Dr. Richard Harris ending that story from Elsie Adamo, with additional reporting from Sam Bradbrook and Josh Brine.
All around the country, you're on ABC Australia Wide.
Like, say the swimming carnival, I can tell them about how, like, the races are, and as well there's a big carnival, like, where we show our house colours.
You've never done that before?
No, not really, no.
There are more than 30,000 workers from the Pacific Islands working in farms in Australia under what's called the PAM, or Pacific Labour Mobility Scheme. Seen as a mutually beneficial arrangement, Aussie farmers get workers and neighbouring Pacific Islanders get job opportunities. But the scheme has seen allegations of exploitation and abuse, and now islanders employed to support PAM workers in Australia are experiencing their own issues with the scheme. Lucy Cooper has this story for us.
Underpaid by $16,000, Rosa Muller-Norman was at a loss.
I feel bad. I feel terrible about the situation, the treatment of myself.
At the start of last year, Rosa took up a new role as a country liaison officer, or CLO. It's a vital job many have never heard of. 17 CLOs are employed to support more than 30,000 workers under the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility, or PALM, scheme. They act as a conduit between employers and workers, helping with language barriers, pay, welfare, health and cultural issues.
The liaison officer is there to guide them sometimes, advise them, you know, even tell them off sometimes, you know. We tell them, remember your culture, you don't do this just because you're away from home, don't get carried away.
Rosa is one of several CLOs who told the ABC that they went weeks, and in Rosa's case, more than 6 months without pay. While country liaison officers are funded by Australia's Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, DFAT, their pay is managed by the Pacific Island governments who send the workers. Because Rosa is from Kiribati and supported workers from there, the Kiribati government was responsible for her delayed payments.
The first issues were when we hadn't been paid for so long, for many months. We kept asking them, we did ask them, when are we going to be paid?
When Rosa tried to chase the money, the Kiribati government asked her for forms and bank details she had already provided. She also alleges that her former employer, Kiribati's Overseas Employment Unit, misappropriated the money it received from the Australian government for her wages.
I just feel like it was a deal in tactics. But when we went there in November, December, we had like an induction back there. And we asked them why the delay in the payments. And they said the funding had been used for some other project. The funding that was sent specifically for our wages. And yeah, we just couldn't believe that that's what they had done. And then that's why we didn't receive all our due payments, because the funding had been used for something else.
Rosa is not alone.
I would be without wages for 2 months, 3 months, and then I'll get my pay coming in.
David Patanvanu started as a country liaison officer in mid-2024. Born in Vanuatu in 2020, David came to Australia under the PALM scheme to pick tomatoes in regional New South Wales. He too faced issues with his pay soon after commencing his role as a CLO.
The funding was never consistent. I'd get it late and I'm in Australia and I always have to fight back to Vanuatu to try and get the system going, because the Australian government would do their part in paying through to the Vanuatu government, and the, you know, the internal financial process of acquiring the funds through the department was a lengthy process that sometimes just takes forever.
David went for weeks at a time without receiving his wage. He said the only way to get it was in person. David's experience as a CLO left him questioning how effective he could be. If no one supported him, how could he support others?
It's just a role that has been not really looked after. Like, we were supposed to be the ones that are providing welfare and wellbeing support. And what about our welfare and wellbeing?
The Vanuatu government declined the ABC's request for comment. Experts are calling for reform to country liaison officer payments, saying they should be paid directly by the Australian government for their work.
It's completely unacceptable that pivotal welfare staff like country liaison officers are going unpaid.
That's Matt Withers, an Australian National University researcher.
They are frequently overstretched and unable to meet the needs of all palm workers, particularly those in remote locations and communities.
Mr. Withers has been studying the palm scheme for the past 6 years. He says more CLOs need to be employed to support workers, but how they are paid needs to be addressed first.
I think it would make a lot more sense to directly fund these positions through the Pacific Labour Mobility Support Program to ensure timely payment for the work that is being conducted by these CLOs, while their day-to-day work and operations could remain within the remit of those Pacific Island countries.
The ABC has been told that DFAT is updating its mechanisms for co-funding CLO positions, and an outcome regarding this is expected by the end of the year. Rosa Muller-Norman was paid just once, a total of $785 in the 14 months she was employed as a CLO. She's since been paid in full. The Kiribati government sent her a further two payments, but it was the Australian government which had to step in and send her the remaining balance of the $16,000 which she was owed, as well as overtime and other related costs. In an email seen by the ABC, Australia's Pacific Labour Mobility Support Program told Rosa that the payment was being processed in exceptional circumstances only due to the significant delays you have experienced in payment. It was a huge relief for Rosa.
Now that I'm not involved anymore, in a way I'm happy that I got my life back because it was just constant.
A DFAT spokesperson said that the department was aware of issues of delayed payments for some CLOs from some palm scheme sending country governments, and that the department has zero tolerance for inaction on fraud and corruption. The Kiribati government did not respond to the ABC's request for comment. What started out as a desire to help workers from her home country has left Rosa feeling disillusioned.
They just need to be more professional about things. Yeah, I'm glad I'm out of it, but I just don't want it to carry on like what it has been.
Former country liaison officer worker Rosa Muller-Norman, ending that story from Lucy Cooper. You're listening to Australia Wide with me, Sinead Mangan. Now, how are you planning to spend your retirement? Maybe you've got a bit of travel on the cards, or maybe you're thinking, I might spend a bit more time with the grandkids. Well, we're just about to hear from retirees doing the post-work years differently. They've taken up volunteering with Blaze Aid, working to rebuild communities after natural disasters. The organisation rolled into towns across outback Queensland after devastating flooding earlier this year, and our reporter Hannah Walsh tagged along for the day.
Kerry Bennett admits she doesn't do retirement well.
I retired at 70 and I just didn't enjoy retirement as much as I thought I would. This gives me a purpose, and you could probably say it saved my sanity, because it's just so, you meet the most amazing, incredible people, and you make friends everywhere you go. I think my son thought Mum was just going to be an old lady who sat around doing, you know, knitting, and I'm not that type of person at all.
She spent the past 4 months coordinating a Blaze Aid base camp in Queensland's backcountry. Kerry calls Western Australia home, but is temporarily relocated to the tiny town of Junda, where she's been in charge of more than 180 volunteers. Every day she sends them out to rebuild fences, clean homes and be an ear to farmers.
One of my things I do tell them is if the farmer needs to talk, the fence will wait till tomorrow. It's imperative that you let them talk. And it's a big part of what we do. The magnitude of what went on here was mind-boggling, but it's been such an experience. I'd never regret doing what I'm doing. I love it.
And since she started in May, Kerry has rarely taken a day off.
I start round about 6 in the morning and I get out of here about 7:30 at night. We've finished 9 properties now. We've cleared the nearly 218 kilometres of fences that have been down. My average volunteer age at the moment is 63. That will be because I've got the most amazing 90-year-old here. We've served 1,673 meals.
All sorts of people have walked through the door and donated their time, from ex-ringers to backpackers and retirees, bringing whatever skill set they might have.
If you ever sit at the end of one of these tables of an evening and you know all these people that have come from such a diverse walk of and way of life, and they sit here and they all communicate, it's pretty awesome. I often just sit and watch.
On a cattle station about 1.5 hours from Junda, a team of volunteers are constructing a makeshift house for a family that lost everything. Anne-Marie Lloyd and her husband Jeff have been living in a caravan in the nearby town of Yarraka.
We're up at Top Camp, which is an outstation on Jedburgh, that we're trying to... Well, we're getting fixed up just to live in, a temporary accommodation for us. Since we lost the house, we lost all the station complex. So, so I've just got a heap of fellows here helping me, and we'll move up here as soon as it's ready. So, and we did go, literally went from drought to flooding rains in 3 days. Our cows were just starting to feel the effects of the drought. So, wasn't nice.
It's not typical work for BlazeAid, but when retired builder Chris Jacobs inquired about volunteering at Junda, Kerry Bennett knew it was too good to pass up.
We came into Junda on the way through, filled up with fuel and saw the BlazeAid fella. I just thought I'd make an inquiry and see how they're going. And lo and behold, Kerry was there and she said, oh, by God, a job for you, being a builder. I retired a number of years ago, but it's always good to be back on the tools. And when I heard Jeff and Anne-Marie's story, I thought, I've got to be here, you know. I'm getting emotional. Basically, we had a couple of ATCO buildings that we to refit so that Anne-Marie and Jeff could have a home. So that's what we're doing, as best we can. So I realised the complexities of working remotely. So, and we haven't got a Bunnings store just down the road. So you've got to plan ahead, bring what you can, and make do with what you've got.
Heather Ballinger grew up on a neighbouring property and has returned to help coordinate the volunteers.
Found out some were welders, so we grabbed them and did some welding jobs. We've also got some tradies, builders or carpenters, so they're up renovating Top Camp, the outpost, so we've got somewhere for Jeffrey and Emery to move into eventually until they get their more permanent home basis. And we even gave them a little bit of taste of mustering the other day because we needed someone, so we put them on some buggies. And they've been awesome. So willing to put their hand up at everything, always had a smile on their face. If they didn't know it, happy to teach them, or others were happy to teach them. And they just keep coming back, so that's good.
While it might be his first time volunteering, Barry Smith feels at home on outback properties.
I originally come from the Western Riverina in New South in Hay and retired to the Sunshine Coast. As I say, having born and bred on the land, and most of the stuff that we've got to do with repairs or fencing, you're familiar with. Not that I thought I'd be working as fast and as quick as some of the fit young fellows. I thought, well, with what you've learnt and you knew over a period of time, it might be a bit helpful.
Marie Bays is from France, but wanted to experience something different.
It's a very human experience with the other volunteers, but also with the farmers we are helping. So, really love it.
The volunteers are working feverishly to get as much done before the outback summer sets in and temperatures soar above 40 degrees daily. When they do, the BlazeAid camps will suspend. But Kerry Bennett is adamant she will return in the cooler months next year.
These are the most incredible people. how on earth they pick themselves up after what happened here and get up every day and do it all over again. I don't know if I'd have the intestinal fortitude to do it. They just, I'm in awe of them, I really am. They're amazing. I don't want to leave anybody in the lurch. I would love to finish what we've started.
BlazeAid volunteer Kerry Bennett, ending that story from our reporter Hannah Walsh. And that is Australia Wide for this Tuesday. I'm Sinead Mangan. It's been lovely to have your company. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.